I mean, I remember I was presenting at a state science conference. This is quite a few years back. And I was just sharing my experiences of the changes I had in my classroom and what that looked like and how that looked in a science classroom to talk about what we referred to as like target-based grading and reporting. And, you know, I had a teacher come up to me afterwards and she said, "Can you give me any advice?" This conference was always in spring, so it was in March. And she said, "We just found out last week that we're going completely standards-based grading and reporting next school year." And she said, "Any advice?" And I said, "Run." That was my honest advice to her, because there was no way that anyone could do that well. They haven't had any training. They haven't had any implementation process for that, or equip their teachers with the tools that are necessary for their families or their students to be successful with that reform change.
Welcome to the Grading Podcast, where we'll take a critical lens to the methods of assessing students' learning, from traditional grading to alternative methods of grading. We'll look at how grades impact our classrooms and our students' success. I'm Robert Bosley, a high school math teacher, instructional coach, intervention specialist, and instructional designer in the Los Angeles Unified School District and with Cal State LA.
And I'm Sharona Krinsky, a math instructor at Cal State Los Angeles, faculty coach, and instructional designer. Whether you work in higher ed or K-12, whatever your discipline is, whether you are a teacher, a coach, or an administrator, this podcast is for you. Each week, you will get the practical, detailed information you need to be able to actually implement effective grading practices in your class and at your institution.
Hello and welcome back to the podcast. I'm Robert Bosley, one of your two co-hosts, and with me as always, Sharona Krinsky. How are you doing today, Sharona?
I'm doing well. You know, I'm full in my mental switch away from academia and into the theater. I've got some performances coming up to watch my son in, and then we're getting ready to go in the theater. So I'm doing well. I'm very glad to be done with teaching. How about you?
Well, you know, at the time this is recorded, I still have a couple of weeks. I think by the time it comes out, I might finally be done with my semester too, but still in it right now.
Oh, that's amazing. That's amazing. So with us in the virtual studio today, we have Don Smith and Becky Pepler. I hope I'm saying those correctly.
Yes, you are.
We're so excited to have you guys here. Don and Becky are part of First Educational Resources, which we're going to ask them about, but it was established in 2010. When there was recognition of a need for more affordable options for professional learning in K-12 public schools. Becky is the director of the Sager Center, which she will explain later, and her career highlights include serving as a 6-12 instructional coach and a chemistry and forensic science teacher. She received the Excellence in Science Education Award from the Wisconsin Society of Science Teachers, a crucial figure in transitioning the Winnicone, is that right?
Winnicone
yep. Community School District to target-based grading and reporting. Becky's work has facilitated a focus on continuous improvement for both teachers and students. Welcome, Becky.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Right. I'm going to tell a Wisconsin story in just a moment, too. So Don Smith has over 20 years of professional experience in public schools. He previously served as the Director of Teaching and Learning for the Winnicone Community School District in Wisconsin. He's also been a principal and a district assessment coordinator in different places throughout Wisconsin. He continually leads professional development sessions centered on research-based practices in instruction, assessment, and grading. So welcome to the pod, Don.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here.
So I don't know a whole lot about Wisconsin. However, I have suddenly been visiting it a lot more, as my older son is attending University of Wisconsin-Green Bay.
Nice.
So
that's really close to us.
Yeah. So I'll have to see if we can get you guys connected. But welcome.
Welcome, both of you. So we were introduced to you guys kind of by Matt Townsley, which we just had on episode 46, talking about a book that the three of you, plus I think one or two others, co-write, called Extinguishing the Fires Within Assessments of Grading Reform, which if you haven't listened to that episode yet, please go back and listen to it. It's a phenomenal book. I could do another whole hour on just that book. But we wanted to welcome you two as well. And anytime we have new guests on the podcast, one of the first things we always like to do is ask you about your origin story. Like, how did you get involved in this crazy world of alternative grading and grading and assessment reform.
Becky, you just
can go ahead and I can go ahead and go first. I always, when I share this story, you know, when you think about a pivotal moment in your life where you notice that there was a change, right, or something kind of was redirected, and that's really where my story starts. And I assume that so many educators will be able to sympathize with this story as well. And it happened at a night at parent-teacher conferences, and I remember it was our fall conferences, which were typically held in November. And I remember it being our evening. We had one in the evening, then we'd have one the second day during the daytime. And at the time, I had a parent come in. I was teaching forensic science, chemistry, and a college-level chemistry class in the Winnie County Community School District. And I had a parent come in. And at the time, the gradebook for the class her son was taking was broken down. It was 50% came from their assessments, 40% came from their lab work, and 10% of their grade came from their classwork. And so she had come in, and he was taking that college level chemistry class. And she had come in, her son was not with her at the conferences. And she was a little concerned because this was going to be the first grade of her son's college transcript. So she was put a little bit more emphasis on that course and how he was doing. And she really wanted to know how she could continue to support him because it was towards the beginning of the school year. Yeah, beginning of November, we start school beginning of September. And, you know, we had quite a bit of the year left ahead of us. And so we started talking about and looking at, you know, the printout of all of his grades for that particular grading period of time. And she zoned in on the assessment category because it had the greatest weight. And so she zoned in and she said, well, what about this chapter two assessment? And to give you a little bit of context, it was, as I said, the beginning of November. We were already finished with chapter one, two, and three. We moved through those a little bit quicker at the beginning since some of it was review from that chemistry one course. And we were already working on chapter four. And so she said her son had earned a 63% on that chapter two assessment. And she said, well, what does he need to do? Like, what did he miss in that assessment? I assume it's going to be a building block for what you're doing the rest of the year. And while I know that not all parents ask that many questions at parent-teacher conferences, she really wanted to know what she could do to continue to support and help him at home, which was amazing. But it caught me off guard because I couldn't answer her question. I had given that assessment about 3 weeks prior. I had already given it back to my students, so I didn't have it sitting in front of me. And all that was glaring back at me in that grade book was this 63%. And at the time, how our grade breakdown worked, that was right on the edge of a D to a D minus for our grading system. And I had to respectfully tell her that I would have to get back to her on Monday after I had a conversation with her son. And I really had hoped that he still had that assessment that I handed back to him, because I had no idea by looking at that grade book what he did well on and what he needed some additional support or work or needed to do some relearning and, you know, some reteaching with me and relearning on. And so she was very kind, and she said, okay. But I left parent-teacher conferences that evening, and I felt like I was about 1 inch tall. And I did a lot of reflecting. That put me in a huge tailspin spiral of looking at a lot of different things of what did I need to do in my classroom to be able to answer that question? Because I felt that, for one, if I couldn't answer that question, that there was no way that my students could answer that question for themselves either. And that one evening was that pivotal moment for me where I realized that I needed to do something different. I felt that as their teacher, I should always be able to answer that question, and I should be able to do it at the snap of a finger. I shouldn't have to go and ask a student for something back, and I shouldn't have to sift through and maybe allow that to give me the answer. And so that's really what that changing moment for me was. I started doing a lot of research. I started buying every single book that I possibly could from, you know, Tom Guskreen, Rick Wormley, and Ken O'Connor, and anything that I could get my hands on, and started reading articles and started talking to our director of teaching and learning at the time, which was Garth Larson, who was the fourth co-author with us on the Extinguishing the Fires Within Assessment and Grading Reform. And we started to just pick away at what do we need to do differently. And that led me down a pathway of piloting quite a few different practices in my own classroom, learning from some very big mistakes that I made along the way, but then also starting to see the benefit of that change, right, in my classroom. And that's really what got me started. But that's what fuels me today to still be able to share and talk with other schools and work with other schools and educators on these transformative changes, because I got to see the outcome and the positive impact of the increase in that student growth and achievement in my own classroom.
Wow, that's amazing. One of the things that Shrona and I do in a lot of our trainings that we do together is when we're trying to point out some of the issues with traditional grading, we do just that. We, you know, take our audience through a activity where they're looking at a standard traditional points and percentage based grade book and asking, what can you tell me about the students? So to have someone on that actually lived that experience that we're trying to recreate, and that's what turned you on to alternative grading, that's really, really cool. I mean, that's
it's very powerful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Powerful. How about you, Don?
Yeah. So Becky's story, which I always love to hear, because I feel like it's a very organic, natural story that really leads into grading differently. And whereas my story, I was in my second year, picture it's about 2011. I was in my second year being an administrator, an assistant principal in a district where we have about 10 elementary schools, three middle schools and a high school there. And every 3 years, you get to go to a conference, a national conference. I know many districts have similar setups. And I was excited because it was my turn to go. And a couple of my friends were going to a conference down near Chicago. And I'll be honest, I didn't know really what the conference was about. I just knew that some friends were going to a conference near Chicago and it sounded like fun to me. Okay. So I go there and it turns out to be a massive in-person grading conference. And every big name that you can think of back in 2011, I think, spoke and presented there. By the time I was done with those essentially 2 or 3 days, I don't even remember who I went with anymore, but I remember nearly everything I learned when I was there. And it was one of the most powerful transformational events that I had in terms of my thinking. And then I came back to my district. And at the time, we were kind of in transition with the leadership within the district. Like I said, I was an assistant principal at one of the middle schools. And about a couple of weeks later, I'd set up a meeting with our superintendent. And I was passionate about this conference. I had a couple of pages of notes. I think I still have them somewhere. And he essentially he's a fantastic leader and a great guy. And he goes, "You seem really passionate about this. Do you want to help lead our district through it?" And I kind of chuckled. And he said, "No, I'm being serious. Do you want to help lead our district through it?" And I was like, "No, I definitely don't." And that's when he kind of did the jokingly other duties as assigned, and off and running we were. So I got to work with some fabulous coaches that we had at the time. And then in my third year in the district, we had a new district director of instruction who kind of joined me and really came on and helped us lead our district through that change. So by the time I left from kindergarten through 12th grade, we had shifted to a 4-point scale proficiency-based grading kind of system within that. And I was there then for about 3 or 4 years. And then I got a chance to shift to other districts where then I got to say, I always learn from my mistakes, because that first time you kind of work through it, there's a lot of different, I don't want to say errors, but things we would have done differently. And I learned a lot. I mean, when I go from being an assistant principal in one of the middle schools to helping lead the entire district through it, it was a massive learning curve. And so that's kind of where my story kind of begins with it, is just, you know, the other duties as assigned, and we were off and running. So
I love getting these stories and hearing some of the similarities and the differences in our experiences. I think, Don, you're the first person that has come on and said that your origin started with a conference, which is actually really refreshing to me, because besides just grading reform, one of my big things that I have been championing for even longer than grading reform is PLC. And my journey into the PLC world and really trying to champion that was the same thing. It was, you know, going to one of the DeFore Solution Tree PLC conferences and just coming back, like, not just drinking the Kool-Aid, but like bathing in it, just coming back fired up, ready to go. And like, this is what we need to do. So it's kind of cool, even though it was two different types of reforms, it's still that conference really drove you. So, talking about speed bumps and stuff, that's one of the other things I know Sharona and I talk a lot about in our trainings is, you know, one of the backbones to any kind of alternative grading is the idea that we learn from mistakes and feedback loops and, you know, messing up, trying to figure out why we messed up and doing better. And we're like, that's what you expect your students. You got to give yourself the grace too, because I do not know too many people that have ever done any kind of alternative grading, whether it's standards-based, whether it's ungrading or contract grading or anything else, that did it really well the first time.
Yes. So true.
So speaking of conferences, there two other origin stories we wanted to ask you about. One of them is the company you work for, First Educational Resources LLC. And secondly, within First Educational, there's the Steger Center, right? Mm-hmm. So who wants to go first with that one? Where did those come from?
I'll jump first with talking about FIRST. And FIRST was started by Garth and Tammy Larson, who you heard Garth reference before as one of the co-authors on our book. And I think it was back in the day, like, it was originally called Wisconsin Educational Resources, because basically Garth was at some events, if you ever get a chance to talk to him and hear the story, that he kind of came back one night. He was talking to his wife, Tammy, and he said, I just think we can do this better. This can be done better for educators, eventually for kids, that PD in general can be done better. And so that was the original story of how he, Garth and Tammy, started FIRST. And from then, it's completely grown to the point now we have 9 centers within FIRST Educational Resources, ranging from, said, the Steger Center, which stands for Standards, Targets, Assessment, Grading, and Reporting, to a PLC, to we have a Collective Efficacy Center with Jenny Donahue, and we could keep going on and on, instructional coaching, math, literacy. I know I'm missing something there, Publishing Center, of course. But just know that we've worked with over 2,000 districts really all over North America, and we're pretty excited about it because we continue to work with and serve more and more teachers and students kind of around North America.
That's incredible. I had no idea you guys had worked with that many districts. That's really great.
And I think COVID was tough for a lot of folks. And I think we pivoted very quickly during that time to our virtual model of PD. And luckily we have a lot of folks who are quick and agile when it came to the ability to maximize Zoom. And we're really great to have some great people that we work with. So,
well, and that's a lot of where Bosley and I, we've been working together since 2016 with a nonprofit that sounds in some ways similar to FIRST, not in the focus, but in the idea of we can create programs for students better sort of by partnering with the school district instead of being a school district. So College Bridge, which is how we met, is focused on the K-12 to 16 math readiness pipeline. And so it really was focused on this dual enrollment. But because Bosley and I were already working together and we'd already been doing this alternative grading stuff, we had also been piloting some remote teaching stuff in the semester before the pandemic happened. So in the fall of 2019, I was already using Zoom. We were already playing with it because we were looking for scalability models for our dual enrollment program. So when the pandemic hit, he and I actually pivoted our professional development that we had started to do together to an online forum, and it worked really well. So he and I now do a lot of that PD, and that's a lot of what the grading conference does, is providing effective professional development in a virtual space. And we've done 3 30-hour intensives on course redesign for alternative grading entirely virtually. And we're going to start working hopefully with a school district in Michigan this year. And so it's just been really interesting parallels. But yeah, it's weird there's a lot of parallels, but I come from the higher ed world.
Okay.
So, we're doing it from very different perspectives on PD, because PD for faculty who are really mostly novices, higher ed faculty are novices at professional development. I mean, they oftentimes we're the very first PD they've ever had. Wow. And so working with them versus working with high school teachers who have had a lot of professional development, but then they're experience with the quality is very, very interesting.
Saying it nicely.
I'm trying to be nice to the world. I have 3 K-12ers on here. But then, Becky, can you tell us a little bit then specifically about the Steger Center?
Yeah, so the Steger Center is one of the divisions of FIRST Educational Resources. As Don had mentioned, it stands for, we always joke when we named it that we needed one more acronym in the world of education, as if we clearly don't have enough already. But Steger is another acronym. It stands for Standards, Targets, Assessment, Grading, and Reporting. And kind of our goal with the development of that is, how can we work to develop teachers and leaders who have, a comprehensive understanding how all of those things can work together to ensure that all students. And so that's really kind of our vision behind the Steger Center. But the Steger Center actually does a lot of different things. And so a majority of the time, I would say, you know, our consultants and those that are working the Steger Center are out working in schools. And we spend a lot of time, a lot of times it's multiple years with schools or districts as they're working to transform their grading, reporting, and assessment practices. And one of the things that I absolutely love about what we do is that all of the professional development that we provide is completely customized. So we don't just have like these cookie cutter approaches and saying like, you know, when we walk into school A versus school B versus school C, it's going to look the exact same way. Obviously, we have principles and we have, you know, our guiding principles. I know Matt talked a little bit about like our four pillars of grading for impact that we utilize kind of as a standard and a foundational piece. But we really also take into account and value that, you know, some things work in certain ways in, you know, it's dependent upon your school and your district and your staff and your students in your community. And that's all incredibly important as well. So we pride ourselves on organizing and creating professional development to best meet the needs of those schools. The other part of the Steger Center is that we do offer some, you know, virtual conferences and in-person conferences as well that aren't specific to the needs of a specific district, but, you know, gathering from multiple different districts so we can hopefully collaboratively work together and learn from each other also. So we do have our Steger conference that we run twice a year, and that is completely virtual. And then the other big piece of the Steger Center is we've had an amazing opportunity to work very closely with Ken O'Connor, Garth and myself have on with his newest edition of his book, The Repair Kit for Grading, 15 Fixes for Broken Grades. And Ken has given all of the rights over to Garth and I to present and share all of his work. So we do have a huge part of what we do also is two-day Repair Kit for Grading workshops on Ken's behalf. And Garth and I go around and present. We're trying to get more and more of those around the United States. So you see them kind of popping up as we're working to develop those. But that's also another large piece of, you know, some of the work that the Steger Center does.
Yeah, that's one of, you know, the 15 things that I think it's high schools or schools do wrong with grading, and then the repair kit for that are
yep.
Two of those books that were very early on in my reading list in my journey. Mm-hmm. I have not seen anything of, you know, that much about his newest edition. So I'm curious to see what's all in that. That's unfortunately, great. Like Guski was saying when we had him on a while back, the amount of research and books that have come out in just the last like 5 years is growing exponentially. So I'm getting further and further behind on books that I'm trying to read. Although I'll be honest with you, I went through Fire in like 3 days. Like,
wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. We'd love to hear that.
There's a few books that are on my, you know, recommendation list for anyone that's like, here's some great stuff. Here's the ones you have to do. Anyone that is in any kind of training position, any kind of, you know, working more than just your own classroom, that book needs to be like right next to you when you're doing any of those plannings. It fills such a need that I haven't seen any other books do it. And like I was telling Matt when he was on, I've personally experienced 14 out of those 16 fires. Like
I got all 16. Yes.
Well, then we hit the spot, I hope.
Not all as an educator. There's one of them that I only got as a parent. Okay.
But that's great, right? So you still have had at least had that experience.
As you probably can guess, when we were brainstorming the list, it was significantly longer as you guys probably have had other experiences, and we had to cut them down and try to merge a couple of them just to keep it to a shorter book that didn't get too long. But it's great to hear you guys think or have great things to say about it. Because our goal was you could really just do a chapter at a time with a team to say, let's take a look at this fire. Either we don't want to experience it or we are experiencing it. How do we prevent it from potentially happening? Or how do we help extinguish this so it doesn't completely derail really what we're trying to do? So that's awesome that you guys say great things about it.
It's definitely added to our toolkit. And I was going to mention Ken O'Connor's work has been actually very crucial. We have one piece of his that we use in every one of our presentations. We cite him, but it is the parachute packing problem. And we are constantly, you know, it is the culmination of our, we have an entire What's Wrong with Traditional Grades segment. We can either do it as a full hour and a half, or we can cut it down, but we walk through. And a lot of times we're working with math teachers just because we both come from math. A lot of the higher ed work in this area grew out of the math departments, and math departments at higher ed are the ones under the most pressure to get a lot of their grades up and their and pass rates. So we actually go through the math. We do the math. We do the averages. We give the different things. And then we put up the parachute packing problem. We're like, you know, who do you want to pack your parachute? Oh, hey, they all have the same average, you know? So that's usually the culmination of that part of the talk.
And that's awesome.
Often by then we can at least get math professors like ready to just be totally disgusted. Not always. A little bit of a brutal punch at times.
The other thing I was going to add on to kind of what Becky said, and I think that what I, one of my points of pride with our team, and I had heard this, I was listening to one of your earlier episodes where you guys had, and you were discussing in the end, like, there's no really right or truly wrong way. And like our team, when you hear about us coming together, Becky, Garth, and I, and our other team members, we did come from, even though we all eventually came together in Winneconne in Wisconsin, where we kind of merged at one point in time, we had different paths to get there. And that we really learned from each other. In fact, Garth and I, which was funny, like before I was in Winneconne, when he and I were in different districts, we actually sat down one time at a curriculum director meeting and argued about his 3-point scale versus my 4-point scale. And we were all having this massive discussion about it. And in the end, the cool part is when we come together, as you heard Becky say, like our goal is customized because we all come from different spots. And it really is like, does it work for your teachers? Does it work for your students? Does it work for your parents? And if it doesn't work for one of those groups, it won't work. And there are many times we get called into situations where it is a fire, like to quote the book, of something going on and they want us to help put it out. It's because it's not working for one of those groups. And so then it's really, how do we take a look at draw from our experiences to say, what is a potential good way moving forward with that? But really we come from different spots, which is kind of fun at times. So it provides great dialogue internally. But it really is just that idea of like, I can't remember which episode you guys had, but it was just the idea of there are more than one ways to do this. And we're not ever set on just, this is how it has to be done. It's really, let's study what's going on with your teachers, your community, your kids, and really what will work today. And then what would work in a couple of years, you know, like let's create a path to help move forward. So.
Well, and I'd like to say, we talk to all of our people, we say there is no one right way. I teach 3 different classes. I teach a history and math class, linear algebra, and general education statistics. And all 3 of them have different grading systems. And I'm one person. So if one person isn't even going to do it the same across 3 preps, then how do you expect 2 people to do it the same or 3? And I have lived in the course coordination world. So I have been able to get people to the same spot. Like we literally teach all of our sections of our GE statistics with the exact same grading system. But that was the product of 6 years of continuous development on the part of the team. So yes, 100%. No one right way. Right, Boz?
Yeah, but that's, you know, we have something similar, actually the exact same name, but we have what we call the 4 pillars of alternative grading, because there is so many different ways to do this. And you know, we talk about grading being one of the most personal relationships you'll have with the students. And what works for me in one class isn't going to work with someone else because it's a different class. It's a different group of students. But, you know, any kind of alternative grading, if you are meeting these 4 pillars, which are though worded slightly different than what you guys have, are virtually the same.
I think the main difference is actually a contextual one, because our 4 pillars really did come from the higher ed world, the people who wrote them. So
Dr. Robert Tavern.
Right. So reporting academic grades and non-academic grades separately is not usually an option at the higher education level. So what we tend to stay instead is, if you have something that you would consider not directly assessing the content of the course, I want you to write a learning outcome on it anyway. So I have learning outcomes about learning. Some people do learning outcomes about growth. Some people do learning outcomes about meeting personal goals. And that's where we would reframe those things that we have students do that may not be directly showing us evidence of content, but maybe they're showing evidence that they know how to learn, or they're showing evidence of growth, or they're showing other things, you know? So that's where that changes up a little bit. And we also don't strictly say that formative practice is not counted. So we have helpful feedback in there. And the other thing that we have is, you guys have sort of combined 2 of ours, because you say report student proficiency against specific learning targets. Mm-hmm. We've split that into, first, you have to have clear learning outcomes. And then you're going to assess their proficiency. So we actually have that in too. Nice. But the other difference there is most K-12 systems do have outcomes, whether or not, we always say they're not necessarily the ones you're actually going to assess against. But with Common Core being so common, you guys actually have learning outcomes. Higher ed, have you seen some of our learning outcomes? I've said this before. I was handed my history of math sample syllabus from the department. And like the first three learning outcomes were learning outcomes. And the fourth learning outcome was students will take a field trip to the Huntington Library.
Okay.
I'm like, not a learning outcome. And then something about, we will look at, you know, race and gender. Okay. Like, not a learning outcome. So it was really interesting. I kind of had to really reformulate that. But. So I wanted to ask you then, so where do things stand now? What are you seeing in the K-12 world? Because, you know, we're seeing in the news, you know, we know personally LA Unified's just gone to a huge equitable grading policy, but then we're seeing districts walking it back. Like, what's sort of the state of the world?
Yeah, I would say, you know, if I had to kind of put it all into one package, right, and kind of, because obviously, you know, different districts, obviously things are looking incredibly different, but we are seeing a huge increase in the number of districts that are committing to take a deeper look at their grading, reporting, and assessment practices, realizing that there's a space for that conversation, realizing that there maybe are inequities in the systems that they currently have in place and how those inequities are reported and communicated and shared and what implications that has on our students, depending upon whether that's from elementary to middle, middle to high to whatever students choose to do post-secondary, but starting to see some of those differences in what, I would say, opportunities are available for students stemming back to how did they earn the grades that we are giving them and what impact does that have? So I think that's a huge positive, thinking about, you know, from our world of supporting schools in those initiatives and those ideas and those changes and those reforms, is that a lot more schools are wanting to start a conversation. So I think that's really, really great. We've also seen where you mentioned that some schools are kind of stepping back a little bit. And at least from my personal experience, the schools that we've supported, because we also get schools who will reach out to us and say, hey, we started this a few years ago and here's what we're running into. Are you able to come in and try and help and support us and get us either back on track or figure out where our missteps were along the way? So we don't always support schools from the beginning of that process, right? But sometimes we're called in throughout the process. And one of the things that I noticed there, and I know Don can speak a little bit more to this as well, is that schools that are choosing to step back, I would say 99% of the time, the choice to step back is because of a flaw in the implementation process or how the plan or lack thereof potentially was created in that movement forward. I mean, I remember I was presenting at a state science and I was just sharing my experiences of the changes I had in my classroom and what that looked like and how that looked in a science classroom to talk about what we referred to as like target-based grading and reporting. And, you know, I had a teacher come up to me afterwards and she said, can you give me any advice? This conference was always in spring, so it was in March. And she said, we just found out last week that we're going completely standards-based grading and reporting next school year. And she said, any advice? And I said, run. That was my honest advice to her, because there was no way that anyone could do that well. They haven't had any training. They haven't had any implementation process for that or equip their teachers with the tools that are necessary or their families or their students to be successful with that reform change. So my personal experience is those step backs are usually because there's a flaw in the implementation plan or how it was carried out, whether it was too fast, we didn't think of everything that needed to be thought about, we didn't dot all of our I's, cross all of our T's, et cetera.
And I would say, I was just gonna to add on, and Becky's correct, and I think one of the things we always tell folks is that it's not always the conversation that occurs, whether it's in a staff meeting, sometimes at a parent-teacher conference, it's when you get cornered in a grocery store or you get cornered at a local potential bonfire where you're talking to someone and it's later in the evening and someone says, tell me what the heck is going on over there. And when that person can't respond, it then leads to a frustration, and that just continues to grow and grow and grow. Hence like their fires book again, of just this idea of how do you have these moments where everyone feels as best we can prepared. So when you get cornered in a grocery store and someone says, what the heck is going on over there, that you have the ability to say, at the very least, I don't know, but let's find out more. you know? And so too often that where it doesn't go well, it's someone somewhere. And one of the biggest things we also talk a lot about is educating kids with it, because if the students can answer the parents' questions, that calms a lot. So back in Winnicottie, back in the days, I remember I was part of one time, we just went around and did listening sessions with all the kids. And then from there, created FAQs for staff members to help respond to kids and parents, because then we knew that how we could help support them. Just because if the kids could answer the questions, it could really help out. So, and just the other part I was going to add on, another thing we're seeing across the nation is we're working with a lot of schools who started this back in 2008, right? And they have us come in. And the first thing we do is we call it a stagger analysis. So really, it's a standards-based grading practices analysis that we do with folks, where we spend the whole day in a building meeting with teams and talking to them. Because when you ask about trends, we're seeing a lot of places that started this in 2008, and they might have a single staff member left from when they implemented it. And nobody there was part of the organic movement, including the leadership anymore. And so what they originally started out as in 2008 versus what you see today, 16 years later, is a very different scenario. And so that's one of the things we're seeing, is folks needing support with that.
Yeah, the one other thing I would add on to is kind of a trend is schools even just looking for clarity, right? Clarity in what we teach, clarity in what we want our students to know and be able to do, and clarity in how we're going to communicate that learning. And so that's been, because obviously there's some pushback. We say you walk into certain schools or certain districts or certain communities. And so we've seen a lot of schools just even taking the lens of, okay, let's just focus on clarity and then see how where that gets us to what we want to do with our grading and reporting practices and how we assess and gather that evidence and communicate that, but through that lens of clarity. So that's been something, that trend kind of that I've noticed over the past few years as well.
And it's interesting that you brought that up, Don, about how different staff can get. I've experienced the same thing at my school with PLCs. Like, we really dove deep into, you know, reading some of the PLC books, going to some of the PLC conferences as a school back in the early 2010s. There is like a handful of people at my school that were there when we began it, and our implementation of PLC and the PLC process looks very different now than it did when we started because of that. So I definitely see that, how that can be a huge issue with any kind of standards-based grading or grading reform. But I also have seen something else, and I'm curious to get your two opinion on this, because one of the differences that I've seen between working with K-12 educators and higher ed educators is K-12 wants it now. Like, you want me to do this? Fine. Show me how to do it. Show me how to set up my LMS system. Tell me what you want to do. Like, it's not just the admin, it's teachers, it's admin. It seems to be a universal thing with K-12 educators. Like, we're like, fine, just tell me what you want to do and
let me do it tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Without going through what we've discovered personally and what we've seen in a lot of the research and the writings, that if you don't really go through the process of understanding the why and some of the process of really developing this for yourself, it's going to fail. I don't see that as much in the higher ed. Like, the higher ed educators seem to be willing to go, oh, you think this is going to take us at 2, 3, 4 semesters? Okay, no big deal. Anything that takes more than a month.
It's more like, thank God you don't want me to change for next semester. That's already 3 months from now. That's too soon.
Yeah, but K-12 educators, I mean, if it's more than a month, no, like, we've got to do it now. I'm curious if you guys have kind of seen that same mentality, or is this something that's unique to Southern California?
Becky, if you don't mind, let's jump in. In the book, Fire Number 6 is Why Can't We Just Take Someone Else's Priority Standards and Learning Targets, connects to that. If we see that a lot of, you guys have already done this, can't we just steal what you did? But what you said is so important, Boz, of the need to go through the process. Because I always say it, when I go back to when I was in college, I was a geology major and environmental science minor. I was not a major in the Wisconsin science standards. And those are very different. And it's really important to slow down and go through the process. And folks do want to just take it. But one of the things we're also seeing is districts that have done, like, so if you're in a larger district like you are, to bring all of your teachers together to go through that can take in itself too many years. And then the amount of turnover you have in that period of time, the teachers might be gone. And so there's districts we work with where all of their learning targets or proficiency scales are given to all the teachers. Well, at a certain point, they're going to look at those and say, well, what the heck are these? You know, and so what we're seeing is then even when it's just given to them, they then question what they are because they don't have the understanding of what these actually are or where they came from. And so I see that. And Becky, I don't know if there's anything else you want to add on to that.
Yeah, I would say I see it both ways, right? And I think it's really based upon, like, I see some, you know, as I work with schools for, you know, 2, 3, or 4 years consecutively, depending upon where we're getting started within this process. And I see some teachers who are, you know, kind of a more of a resistance, right? Like a pushback and a pushback and a pushback to kind of that change. And, you know, but really when I get to the root of it and have conversations with them, they're just fearful because they can't see how it's going to work or what it's going to look like. They're really not resistant about the why. I think a majority of staff are like, yes, like we totally understand why we shouldn't include academics, you know, and behaviors and merge them together. You know, we totally understand why we want to offer students an opportunity to be reassessed. We totally understand those things, but we don't know how to do it, or we don't know what it's going to look like in our classrooms or how we're going to communicate that. And so that's where I see, you know, the side of that where we're like, okay, no pushback. We don't want to go there yet because we don't necessarily feel comfortable, but it's not that a majority of our educators are not willing. I do see kind of what you were saying, Boz, too, like the opposite of that, where we're like, okay, let's just go. And some of the times that's because of excitement. Like, I've been waiting for this. Like, finally, we're going to have more meaning in how we communicate, you know, what our students are doing and what they know and, you know, what we're doing as a result of that. But then I also see, you know, some of that mentality being like, well, this is just another initiative and it's not really a reform change. And sometimes I hear that then too of like, okay, let's just go. It's just something else that our district is going through and they're just going to put in next year. It's going to be something different. You know, and 2 years later, it's going to be something different. So in all honesty, I think I've seen it from all different sides and angles. And there's always a reason why, you know, the staff feel that way or those educators feel that way. But one of the big pieces I would say, and I'm wondering if this is kind of a question I have where you're seeing that difference in, you know, the higher ed versus the K-12, you know, does the higher ed have like a very clear plan laid out of what that looks like over the sequence of the years? And is that why you think, you know, like maybe they're more...
Absolutely like, not.
You know, okay. I was just curious. So I was trying to, in my head, think through, I'm like, I wonder why that is. Like, I wonder why that difference is, you know?
So keep in mind, in my experience, the vast majority of higher education educators are islands.
Very true.
PLCs, not even a thing.
Not existent.
Work with one other faculty member on your teaching, maybe. So it's more like, I think the big difference is, certainly with tenured faculty, you don't get the turnover that you get in K-12, because it takes 7 years to get tenure at an institution. And then once you have it, the number of people who give it up are very small. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, 70% of higher ed educators are adjuncts. I'm an adjunct. Bosley's an adjunct. So that turnover is very high, but the expectations are very low. So it's like, hey, you have a master's in math? Great. We're going to put you in a classroom. Period. End of story. We can understand what you say. We can see that you have a little teaching experience. We know you can teach pre-calculus. Boom, you're in a classroom. That there's no training. I barely get told what the approved textbook is, right? So the people who are even considering this are essentially on the bleeding edge. And they come in all kinds. Like me, I found out about this and 3 weeks later, I had 3 brand new classes. Start of the semester and off we went. I know other people who we trained a year and a half ago and they're edging their way towards it, but they're just processors, they're thinkers. Mm-hmm. So it's a very differently paced environment. I don't know, Boz, what would you add to that?
And I think also part of the difference is most of the higher ed that I've worked with, you know, the exception of one small group, it's been individuals doing it in their individual classes. It's not trying to do it, you know, even in a PLC or a department or a whole school or bigger. It's just the one classroom. So I think
that's changing.
Yeah, it's starting to change, but that's still mostly where I see it. So I don't see as many in the higher ed that have the high school or the K-12 mentality of this too shall pass. Just tell me what you want to, you know, just tell me what you want me to do and I'll set it up and, you know, wait 3 years until it passes too.
Well, and higher ed educators have a much higher degree of control. Most of them, not all, mm-hmm. but the vast majority of higher ed educators is basically my classroom is my kingdom and your influence stops at the door. Less so with adjuncts, but there's a little bit of that. And then mm-hmm. there's some institutions that, I mean, we've heard of some institutions that have mandatory normal grading curves. You have to use a bell curve. Just, and since we teach the history of grading and the eugenics nature of the bell mm-hmm. curve, it's really, so it's just, it's definitely a different world, but it's moving in that direction. But one thing you said a while ago, and Dawn, when you were talking about this, I want to loop back around it. You said you went and talked to the kids so that the kids could talk to the parents. One of the fires that I am personally dealing with right now is administrators thinking that my newfangled grading system is way too hard for students to understand and that freshmen can't possibly be expected. And that's why they're not doing well, because they understand traditional grading. And I'm like looking at these administrators saying, I've got an hour and a half presentation to prove to you that you don't understand right. traditional gradings, let alone the students. And don't get me started on Canvas and LMS grading systems that don't treat blanks as zeros. they have a warning that they put up on Canvas at the end of the semester, two instructors that say, don't forget to go back and put your zeros in because the grades are different. And so all of a sudden, week 15, all these zeros go in and students who think they have a 73 suddenly have a 33.
Wow. That's terrifying.
I mean, I could go on for hours. Yeah. I have gone on for hours. I have a podcast with 47 episodes.
One of the things that I think I would like to always like highlight about Becky when she did in her classroom is her involvement, I think, of students. And Becky, if you wouldn't mind kind of talking about whether it's in the reassessment process or just how you had them self-evaluate relative to the same scale. I don't know if you would mind chatting about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think that was a pivotal piece for me. And again, I made a lot of mistakes in implementation and I was trying to navigate it, you know, in isolation at first, right? From that pivotal evening of that parent teacher conference, I'm like, okay, let me try. You know, and I, again, had administration who was totally backing me to say, okay, yeah, try and let us know how that goes, Becky. And, you know, let's see how that works. And, you know, eventually we got there as a district, which was amazing. But that was something that I didn't know at first. It was more like, you know, I look back and I feel like grading is always something that we did to kids, right? When I think about like those traditional grading practices that we did and I reflect back on those. So even when I started to shift and change how I did that, I still felt like when I look at it now, I still felt like my mentality was, well, we're doing that to kids because that's the way that it was done, even though I was changing kind of some of those practices along the way. But when the kids started to get it, is when we put some of that ownership back on them and also let them be in the driver's seat for some of those conversations and some of that work as well. And that took time, right? That was definitely not something that happened overnight. That happened after, you know, years and years of progression, putting things here and there. But I love how Don always says that too. It's like when the kids get it, we know it's working, right? Like, I mean, when they can go and explain and they can have those conversations, that is transformational, but they have to be involved in the process to be able to do that. You know, like we can't just pull the curtain down and just be like, well, they'll just get it eventually, you know, kind of thinking of your example there as well, saying like, well, they don't want to understand that process. Well, what are we doing so that they do understand that process? Because we know this is what's good for kids. And so the more that we can do that, so I found huge value in like student self-reflection and self-assessment after we had assessments, you know, whether it was an end of unit assessment, you know, on the learning targets or objectives that they were being evaluated on. But it wasn't even so, like I taught high schoolers. I had majority juniors and seniors. I had some sophomores in the classes that I taught. But we can't also just assume that they know how to do those things. You know, I was thinking, yeah, I'm going to do self-reflection and self-evaluation. I have this great form that I'm going to use. I'm going to give it to them the day after. They're going to get their assessment back. They're going to kind of go through it, talk in pods. We're going to talk as groups. I'm going to move around the classroom, you know, go through it. Well, it failed epically because the kids had no idea how to self-reflect. And, you know, just even asking them like, okay, analyze all of the, you know, all of the evidence that you have from, you know, learning target one, you know, I can balance a chemical equation or whatever it was. And, you know, they're looking, they're like, I don't know, I got number one and two wrong. I don't know. You know, like they didn't know how to self-reflect. So I had to teach them, you know, but once we taught them that and they saw the power and value of it, that completely changed. Because I got a little pushback at first, because we would take a full day to like self-evaluate and self-reflect after our end of unit assessments. And so we would have like 10 assessments throughout the school year, kind of like if I was kind of to break it into units. And I would take a full day after to go through self-evaluation. And I got a little pushback at first, because they're like, Becky, you're giving up 10 instructional days to do self-reflection. And my response was, absolutely, because the value that came as a result of that and the reteaching, relearning that happened just in that moment. And how did that prepare them for the reassessment that was, you know, that I was hoping that they would have coming down the road if they chose to do so, was so monumental and became such a huge part of our classroom. But that took years, right? That didn't just happen overnight. And I think that comes, reassessment is one of probably my favorite topics to talk about. But I always ask too, schools, like, okay, they're like, my reassessment policy is not working. The kids aren't taking advantage of it. I just did an analysis actually that Don was sharing with, the Steiger analysis. And one of the comments as I was writing the reflective piece today about reassessment was, I've only had 5% out of all of my students all year. And the first person just asked for a reassessment now, and it's mid-May. Like, but why is that happening? And a lot of the times I truly think it's because we haven't actually told kids why we are allowing them an opportunity to be reassessed. I mean, you think of a high schooler and you think of them just saying, yeah, you get another chance to reassess, you know, you get another chance to do that. Okay, free for all, right? I'm not going to study this first time. I'm just going to come in and I'm going to do this, right? But do they understand why they have that opportunity? And I think that's the piece that we miss sometimes, is truly making sure that the kids understand and taking the time for that understanding to develop. And that's where, in so many of those changes in my classroom personally, that's where I finally found a shift, when the kids understood, but I had to take time to get there first.
So if I could add on, I was going to say, like, and I think Becky is, you probably should have her on for another podcast about reassessment, because I think she's one of the best in the world about it when it comes to that, as you just hear her light up there, just getting into it. And it's just, reassessment is such a hot topic in this whole world, and how to do it. I think a lot of folks are trying, and just, I think Becky's advice on that is so important. The other part is, as Becky talked about, when we talk about kids, I think we always forget our language matters, and just how we introduce that and how we talk to kids. Because one of the things I always say when I'm having a chance to talk to folks is, kids don't come into kindergarten saying, will this be graded? Okay. Unless they maybe had a parent say that. Like, somewhere along the way, we as educators use the grade as a carrot or a stick, and we taught the kids that. And so at some point I always say, I want to do a study. Like, what grade level does that typically come in? And
does
usually it's
stop?
Somewhere around third to fifth grade is when it's uses the carrot and the stick. And the language we use with kids matters, our students matter. And we just create that culture of, we heard Becky is creating a culture of chasing learning, where we have to shift that from kids chasing grades. And so that's really, mm-hmm. the language we use with students is so important. And we as teachers control that narrative far more, I think, than we know we do.
So I have two thoughts that are related to both of those things. One is, yes, 100% yes, we have to teach them. We have learned the hard way, of course, mm-hmm. at the higher ed level, when we have re-attempts available, it does cause procrastination, unless we explain to them that you are going to screw it up badly the first time. So you're not getting a reattempt just as a free for all. It's a woohoo, you have another chance. You're going to do so badly whenever you take it the first time. So if you don't take it authentically the first time we offer it, well, your first time is going to be the second time or the third time. We need you to start to engage in that feedback loop. And we can have that conversation at the university level, because they can kind of understand that.
But, you know, building on that, a few episodes back, we had Dr. Teresa Gaines on, and she was talking about some of her or their grading structures. And there is a very large reflection component to their grades. And it was weird, in their kind of end of class or course survey, the students talked about that being one of the things that they learned the most from and one of the things they hated doing. But it yep. was, you know, even they were reflecting back going, is this too much metacognitive reflection to be asking freshmen and sophomores in college? And I think, Sharona, you made the point at one point, if we don't start it at some point, they're never going to be ready for it. Like, we've got to start that reflection process and teaching our students how to really reflect on mistakes to grow from those mistakes. Because if we don't, then they're never going to be ready for it. It's not something that, oh, you know, you turned a certain maturity. Now, all of a sudden, you know how to reflect on your own mistakes and, you know, and learn from what you did wrong. That's, well,
and,
it's
and
not.
These comments about students not being ready for something, anything at the higher ed world, I'm just like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
You know, come on. I can see a 10-year-old not being ready for, they're literally not developed enough maybe to have a full-blown adult pedagogical awareness or an andragogy, as Owen would say. But come on, these are 18 and 19-year-olds. And yes, they're not 25, they're not 35, they're not 40, but these are full-blown adults. Right. Like, stop with the paternalism. Stop with the, we can't hold our students accountable. Like, right. Come on.
I was going to say, some of the best, and some of the districts we've had the opportunity to work with, some of the best examples of student self-reflection and self-portfolios come at the early elementary, where the students have their priority standards all in a portfolio, and they collect their items of evidence that they believe connect back to those priority standards that show, here's why I'm a 2, 1, 2, or a 3. So I'm like, if a kindergartner and first grade student, yes, we have to teach them, but that's the thing, we have to take the time to do that. If we take the time to do that, some of the, like I said, the best portfolios I will ever see, and it comes down to, is the adult ready to do that? Because kids are, at the youngest of ages, some of the best. Some of the best portfolios came from a kindergarten room where they had the priority standards. The kids knew what priority standards were. They knew, like, in kindergarten terms a little bit, but some of that work has been really impressive that you see folks do.
That's amazing. Unfortunately, we are already coming up on our time. I think we could easily do another hour on this. And
I do want to ask one last closing question, though. Mm-hmm. Okay. If that's okay, Boz. Where do you guys go from here? What's next for the Steger Center and the work that you're doing?
Yeah, I would say kind of what's next is we are always still striving. Our conferences that we run twice a year to best meet the needs of educators and administrators and districts that are trying to do better for their kids, obviously through the world of grading, reporting, and assessment change. So we are always, you know, striving to put together amazing lineups and get feedback from educators about what they need so they can see value in that work moving forward. And I know at the Steger Center, we have big goals, right? Our goal is that we also become what we always call or refer to as a household name, that when schools are looking for the support and looking for somebody to partner with to help them through that process, because we have such great outcomes with kids, once we get that clarity and consistency in what we teach and what we want our students to know and be able to do and how we communicate, that is continually our goal behind the scenes of how do we keep developing, whether that's professional development, whether that's getting out in schools and doing that work, but how do we do that so we can impact more kids, I would say, from, you know, based off of what we've seen happen in our own personal classrooms.
The only thing I would add on to that is if someone attended the very first Steger conference or any of them, every one of our conferences is different. As Becky said, like, unlike Correct. Other events, we don't just put the same one on. There's certain events that, you know, you could go to right now that if you would have gone to in 2016, it's essentially the same event, where we truly try to evolve. And in one of our two conferences we run a year, we always do a Voices from the Field kind of section, where it's people who are actually in the field doing it now, in addition to those of us who had a chance to write a book about it. So one of our points of pride too is how do we involve more educators moving forward? Because as you guys know, as you get to the more people we just interact with, there's more people that are doing it. We're not alone anymore. I just think lastly, back to 2011 when I was there, we had people leave our district, staff members, because we were doing this. Now all of those districts they fled to are now doing it, right? We're not alone. How do we help a network of folks to say we're not alone in this? And it just might look differently, but we can all learn and grow from each other. So
when is the next conference, and where, if people are interested, where can they go to get more information and register and all that?
Becky, you got that?
Yes. I do. Our next conference is October 17th. So this fall, it is a one-day conference. Our theme this year is simplifying assessment and grading reform. And we are just showing that it doesn't have to be an incredibly difficult process to be able to make, even whether it's small change or big change, right? Any change moving in that right direction is a positive change. We have Joe Feldman opening and kicking off for us at our conference. And then we have two sets of breakout sessions, four breakouts each. We have Heidi Hayes-Jacobs, Matt Townsley is presenting, Ken O'Connor is presenting for us, Garth Larson, myself, Myron Duick, Jay McTai are all presenters that we have in our lineup, all through the lens of simplifying. So we like simplifying reassessment, simplifying assessment, simplifying grading practices, simplifying rubrics using AI. All those are kind of some of our topic areas for our presenters. And then we have Myron Duick closing us out with our keynote. So if you're interested in registering, if you go to First Educational Resources, our homepage, and you go to events, you will see the Stagger Conference as a place where you can find out more, see the agenda, and register there.
And we will definitely link that in the show notes as well. And for those of you listening, of course, we are recording this just a couple of weeks before our conference. This might come out just before or just after the grading conference. So don't forget, you can go and register at thegradingconference.com. Registration closes June 10th. So you might be hearing this after that. Sorry about it. Boz, over to you to close this out.
Well, I just wanted to thank you guys both. Like I said, we've already over an hour, and I think we've barely scratched the surface. I'd love to get you guys both back on. But since, Don, you threw it out there, Becky, I'd love to have you on to specifically talk about reassessments and that reflective piece that goes between those reassessments, because I think that's a part that really is missing in a lot of people's kind of assessment and reassessment plans. So, but it was great talking with you guys. It's great to know, you know, like you were saying, we're seeing a lot of these like small pockets going on, and it's great to see that we're starting to bring some of those pockets together. It sounds like you guys are at the First Center is really bringing multiple districts, making these small pockets bigger, which is what, you know, I think we really need to start doing to get this traction really going and, you know, undo 100+ years of harmful grading. Yes. So thank you both very much.
Yeah, thank you.
And we will see everyone next week on the pod.
Please share your thoughts and comments about this episode by commenting on this episode's page on our website, www.thecreatingpod.com, or you can share with us publicly on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. If you would like to suggest a future topic for the show or would like to be considered as a potential guest for the show, please use the Contact Us form on our website. The Grading Podcast is created and produced by Robert Bosley and Sharona Krinsky. The full transcript of this episode is available on our website.
The views expressed here are those of the host and our guest. These views are not necessarily endorsed by the Cal State system or by the Los Angeles Unified School District.